Welcome to the Hardware Asylum Podcast. This episode, we talk about the worst storage media of all time, including papyrus, tablets, and zip disks. I'm your host, Dennis Garcia, and with me today, I have Darren McCain. I've been doing quite a few videos on YouTube lately, and one of the latest ones was about gaming in the 80s.
Oh yeah, from your retro PC stuff.
Yeah, there was one game that I played a lot as a kid called Hack, or PC Hack. It was a game that I would play on my Tandy 1000, and it was large enough that it only fit on one floppy disk. And to play the game, you had to save a file to another floppy disk, and then spawn a RAM drive to generate all these crazy levels.
That's really interesting. Put that in perspective a little bit. Is that like pre-Zork? Because I think for a lot of us, Zork is kind of the first game most of us have heard of.
Zork was that text-based game, right? Where you had to read everything and say, hey, you want to turn left and now you see a door sort of thing?
Yeah.
It was around that era, yes. So this was a, Hack was an ASCII-based dungeon crawler.
Oh, okay. So it generated actual maps?
Yeah, generated maps, and it was all RNG-based. You've heard of the term roguelike game, right?
Yes, yes.
So Hack, or PC Hack, was a roguelike game because it was actually a MS-DOS port of Rogue, which was a very similar game that was written on Unix.
Which is where the term comes from.
That's where the name comes from.
Ah, I did not know that.
And PC Hack was the basis, along with a couple other games, for NetHack, which is a game that you can still download today.
Now I have heard of NetHack.
The thing was, back in PC Hack days, when I played it on the Tandy 1000, the lowest common denominator was a 5 1/4 double-sided double-density disk.
Oh, that's a mouthful.
Yes, huge mouthful. And what was not so glamorous, or kind of was, depending on your perspective, it only held 360K of data, which is just, you can't even get a picture that small these days, right?
Right.
Since the game was just large enough to fit on one disk, to play it, you had to do a lot of crazy things like spawn a RAM disk. And then if you had two floppy disks, then you had the ability to code it to say, hey, use this other drive to look for the save files. Because if you got far enough into the game, that save file was actually larger than the executable and it wouldn't ever fit on the same disk.
I don't know. That's clever.
So as I was looking around at this and doing some research, I found an article on Extreme Tech. It's titled "The Worst Storage Mediums of All Time." And okay. I thought it might be kind of fun to talk about because while the 5 1/4 floppy disk is not the worst storage medium around, it did have a lot of limitations and led the charge for, the standard 3.5 inch floppy disk that some people call a hard disk, but it's still a floppy disk that was now the save icon on every application imaginable.
Seems like a fun concept. I'm interested to see what they picked.
All right. So the first one, and there's really no context here of why they picked these things, but
I'll have to link to this.
Yeah.
Okay.
The first one is cave paintings and petroglyphs.
All right.
We know what petroglyphs are. These are, basically the pictures that ancient humans drew on cave walls, either to tell a story or just to, be malicious or whatever.
Now, I know they have those in our neck of the woods, but I first saw the petroglyphs when I was visiting the City of Rocks in Utah. I think it's where I first saw them, right off the side of the road. And I was amazed at how big they were.
Yeah, the amazing part was is that ancient humans figured out a way to create paint. And as I understand it, they just chewed on it and then spit. Like if they were going to make an imprint of the hand, they just spit that out on their hand.
Right.
And, made a mask, right? Well, what they had created is still on the walls today. That's just amazing to me. They claim that this is the worst storage medium because they contain little information that modern scholars can use to place them in a historical context of the culture. We just have really poorly drawn antelopes and stuff like that. So we know that those antelopes existed back then, but why did they draw them? And of course, the other one is that they're not exactly portable.
Oh, yeah. Well, I can see the whole context thing, right? But yeah, I wonder if it's really designed to tell a story, if it's just art. Who knows?
It could have. Well, it's hard to say. There's a little anecdote that they included here. It's something they pulled off the internet. In quotes, "What time is it?" you ask. I pull out my 2.7 metric ton granite sundial and immediately crush both of your feet. I loudly announce, it is cloudy.
Nice. Not a double-sided medium, even.
Not.
These... Oh, it gets worse. Well, maybe better. Okay.
Speaking of double-sided medium, we have the next on the list is clay tablets.
Excellent.
And there has been a lot of very historical things written on clay tablets. Hieroglyphs we find in pyramids all over the world. We have the Rosetta Stone, which was a Greek translation of ancient Egyptian, so that we know what the hieroglyphs mean. But had that tablet not existed, they were just art.
I'm reading this and it says the very first customer complaint was written on a clay tablet. I find that appropriate.
Actually, I read about that too. And it really was a complaint. Somebody just boom, 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 and then give it to them. It's like, it's pretty heavy, pretty big.
Got to be really mad to carve it into a rock. Yeah. Okay.
Crude form tablets beat out giant rocks because they're portable.
Ooh, look at that technical data. This entertaining estimate suggests data density for a clay tablet is roughly 2.6 words per centimeter squared, or roughly 3,000 words per kilogram of clay.
Ah, fun.
Single density.
Yep. The next one is scrolls.
All right, that one I get.
With scrolls, you know, we hear about scrolls all the time. Again, going back to ancient Egypt, we have stuff that's written on papyrus. The nature of a scroll is that it's on some sort of a paper or on a hide or something, which is it can degrade. They go on to talk about how there was an ancient library that got buried by a volcanic eruption in 79 AD. And once they dug it up, they noticed that some of the scrolls were burnt, and they call out how they look like burnt up dog turds.
That's a good picture there.
A lot of them had decayed, which is what you would expect. And then several of them that got buried under stuff to keep the weather and the elements away allowed you to read what was on the scrolls. Although it's a little unclear on whether or not the burnt ones were people getting into the library and then burning them, or if they were burnt from the volcanic eruption. But either way, we have a scroll which has, again, limited density. We can't really put a lot on them. We also have a limited context of what was on the scroll and why it was written on the scroll. And of course, they don't last.
Well, this next one is new to me.
I've never heard of this one either. Avco Cartavision? I think I pronounced that correctly.
Cartravision, maybe.
Cartravision. The article starts out talking about how we had a war between Betamax and VHS. Yeah. And VHS won by sucking more and costing less.
That's an interesting way of putting it.
Although I think it was really because the pornography industry adopted VHS because they could put more on it or something like that. But that's neither here nor there. But they talk about the Cartavision, which sucked in ways VHS could only dream about.
Okay, now this is interesting. You had to have a separate machine. No, this one didn't have a separate machine. The only units commercially available were TVs that included an integrated Cartavision system, I guess, which cost $1,350 in 1972, the equivalent of about $8,500 today. So you'd pay, $8,500
almost
to
nine,
watch these things.
$9,000 to buy a TV so we could watch a Cartavision tape.
Cartavision used a skip field system in which only one field, half a frame of data, was recorded to save space. This field was then repeated three times. The end result of the system was blurry, jumpy video, and here's the big thing, you could only watch each movie once.
Whoa.
There are no tapes for sale. You had to get the movie from them and send it back because only they could rewind it in a special machine.
Oh, wow.
Holy crap.
And they go on to talk about how they invented DivX and Netflix. DivX, as you may or may not know, was a media format that was supposed to be a play once. You could install the disc and then you would play it. By the end of it, you could not play it again.
Without paying to re-unlock it.
Yeah, I think that was part of the deal as well. And then, of course, Netflix did something similar where they would send you the disc. You basically bought it. When you returned it, you could either rent another one because you got your money back, and that was how they got paid.
Yeah, originally, I think a lot of folks these days think of Netflix as just a streaming service, and we forget the origins. But yeah. I'm sure glad the DivX was killed. I mean, I think a lot of us boycotted Best Buy for supporting that. That almost killed their business.
The next item on the list is one that I have used a lot, and that's the Zip Disk.
Oh, my. Zip discs seem to be around way longer than I expected them to be. The Super Disc Format Wars.
It was slightly larger than a standard 3.5-inch floppy. And the author here says that it was a widely successful through the 80s and 90s, but the Zip disc didn't come out until 94. And it stuck. Really? And it stuck around until around 2000.
Yeah, in fact, fairly recently, the college here stopped supporting Zip discs. That was, I think, the most common format for turning in paperwork for the longest time, which I thought was crazy.
Well, that was how I turned in my artwork when I was in college, because primarily what I was working on didn't fit on a 3.5-inch floppy, and there wasn't any other way to turn in my work. So I needed to have a large format disc that was portable, and the Zip disc worked well for that.
Now, this article doesn't mention it, but it talks about the Zip 100 drives, but I thought towards the tail end they were closer to 250 megabits, Zip 250s.
That is correct. So the very first ones were Zip 100s, and they held 100 megabytes, and you could buy them in PC or Mac format. But little did people know that you could buy a Mac disk and then format it to the PC, and it worked just fine.
And just find the right sale.
Yeah. And of course, the Macintoshes had started to include Zip 100s or with the computer when you bought it. That helped propel Zip disks into every home. And it worked well for artists because the files they worked on were huge.
Man, I remember I just wanted like the super floppy disks that were coming out, and they were crazy expensive because we all thought that was the future.
I think you're talking about the LS120. That is a semi-optical floppy disk. It's the same format as the 3.5-inch floppy, and it had an IDE interface, so it looked like a hard drive, but it was a portable disk. And it was slightly larger than the Zip 100, which is why there was a competing format war between those two.
Right.
And I want to say Zip won it, or iOmega won it, because they released the Zip 250, which is the one you're thinking of.
Right.
Same form factor. They just increased the density on the floppy disk itself. And, yeah, you know, early floppy drives were parallel port, or you could get SCSI ones. SCSI ones are really super expensive. And toward the tail end, you could get internal ones that were an IDE interface. So they, again, they look like your hard drive. But around 2000, 2002, in that sort of an era, that was when writable CD-ROMs came out and DVDs came out. So now you could put, 480 megs on a CD? Or no, it was 720.
Because 680, I believe, was what the industry standard was. Mm-hmm. So they made them 720. And if you had the right machine, you could overburn.
And maybe the overburn was the 700 and something. But yeah, you could put more data on them. And then, of course, when you got writable DVDs, now you have, 4 gigabytes? And some of them are 8.5 gigabytes if you have the double density ones.
And I still have burnable Blu-rays, single density and dual density, which I'll probably have for a while because I use them for archiving.
Well, and of course, now you buy a computer case, it doesn't even have a 5.25-inch drive bay.
No, so, external drives at all.
So if you want to have optical access, you need to get a USB drive to plug it in. And it's not completely dead, but it's gotten to the point where flash media is really the future. And, you know, you can store the same amount of data on a flash disk. You just don't have that archival option anymore.
Yeah, I had to buy an external to go with my last build. I feel like I'm sort of like that get off my lawn guy. It's so hard to find a good one.
Well, speaking of flash media, the next one is one that I can totally agree with being on this list. Most Sony proprietary standards. We're talking about the memory stick.
Oh, memory stick duo, memory stick duo pro. I have a stack of these at my house. I keep meaning to take them down to my local used video game place and, maybe try to trade them for an old movie or something.
Why do you have so many of those?
Because I'm a big Sony guy. I've had lots of Sony machines. And these stupid proprietary things are probably my only complaint I've ever had about Sony. And actually, now that I think about it, maybe Sony backed DivX back in the day. I'm not going to Google that because it'll just make me angry. But I'm
pretty sure they did, actually.
The article has three different ones here, and ironically, I have all three sitting on my desk because the little guys went in the PSPs, or maybe the big guys went in the PSPs. I don't even remember now, but it used to be the only thing that you could get that would upgrade your Sony devices. Of course, they're proprietary. The good news is that fairly early on, those multi-write things that do all your USB needs for your cameras and phone disks and whatever.
Yeah, you're talking about those. Yeah, the multi-card reader.
Yeah, multi-card reader. Cracked the Sony code fairly early on and saved all of us from the hell of having to buy these over and over again. Because you could back up your stuff onto different media and you didn't lose your save games for these little devices.
I remember the Sony memory stick from digital cameras.
Oh, that's right.
Because some of the best digital cameras you could buy were Sony. But I didn't like the fact that I had to buy a special memory stick just to take pictures on it.
An expensive one, too.
And it was super expensive, but it was fast. It worked well with the platform, which is why they did that. I went with other digital cameras that allowed you to plug in just regular memory cards and
stuff. Yeah, you reminded me that for a short period of time, there was a little tiny hard drive that they were trying to figure out how to make work for cameras.
Oh, yeah.
I don't remember if that was Sony or not, but yeah, that was garbage, too.
That got replaced with the Compact Flash. It was the same interface, it's just now it was solid state instead of actually having a disc. One of my early digital cameras had a 3.5-inch floppy disk you put in there.
Oh, wow.
It took really, really small photos, but the fact that it was on a floppy disk made it nice because you could take the disk out, plug it into your PC, and download everything really super fast.
Carry a box of them. They're cheap. I get it.
So the last one they have is a dishonorable mention, and it's the LaserDisc.
Oh, no, that can't be true. LaserDisc was way ahead of its time.
It was super ahead of its time. It was, according to this article here, it was better than VHS because it had more scan lines. Yeah. So you have higher resolution.
Much higher resolution.
The problem with VHS was that it was a magnetic tape. And if your VHS player was slightly dirty, you would have tracking issues. So there would be static and crazy weird stuff on the side part of the screen. VHS allowed you to record to it as well as playing. But with LaserDisc, it had higher quality audio.
Yeah, really, for the time, incredible audio. Early surround sound, fantastic. I can still remember plugging in some of those early movies and blast them through my early sound systems and watching people freak out about the surround sound in your house.
Well, and the crazy thing about Blu-rays and DVDs is that the video that's on there is about the same between a Blu-ray and a DVD. Blu-ray does support a higher resolution, but the primary driver for changing is the audio quality. So you can have more channels, you can have higher bit rates. It just is an all-around better platform because you can store more stuff on it. And this article talks about how the LaserDisc exceeded expectations and some movies would come on multiple discs, so you'd have to go and swap them out and whatnot. And overall, it looks like a record.
But oh, man.
The amazing part was is that this was back in 1978. So these have been around a really long time. And now, of course, you can go to any pawn shop and somewhere in the back will be a stack of LaserDiscs.
But I really feel like this is really pretty close to being revived by some yuppie movement like records have been. And that LaserDiscs, at least from a nostalgia standpoint, might make a comeback because they're gorgeous.
They are.
And you get the huge artwork on the front. Some have had special artwork, great sound that, you know, even by modern days is better than when you, you know, I know we've all had that moment where you go buy an older TV show on Blu-ray or whatever, and you bring it home and plug it in, and you're like, oh, this looks terrible and it sounds terrible.
Well, it's kind of like watching Seinfeld on that Netflix.
Right.
If you get close, you can see all of the film grain because it wasn't recorded in any format bigger than, what, 640 by 480? Or no, it was 320 back then. You know, your standard broadcast NTSC signal was pretty low res.
Oh, yeah, and the sound was terrible. It's amazing what we put up with on broadcast TV because, you know, you look back on it so fondly, but you forget how bad the picture was, how bad the sound was, the static that you had to put up with, you know, the color degradation of early TVs. It's terrible.
Well, technological advancements. To finish up this podcast, I thought it would be fun for us to go and, well, we've been talking about retro sorts of storage systems, but what would be the one that you hated the most?
Oh, that's a difficult question. You know, because there are a few on there that I would maybe mention. Super Audio CD, I threw a ton of money at once, and it was a terrible mistake. They sound great, but wow, for the money. That one I would give an honorable mention as probably the one that I threw the most money at and regret. Mm. You know, I'm a bit of an audiophile. We've talked about that a lot. And I had a friend that was, you know, so excited about how much better these sounded. And at the time, we were all trying to find DAC recordings and stuff. Which was what, you know, reel to reel, believe it or not, was the only way you could get true, what we today would call a soundboard quality audio. Mm-hmm. And Super Audio CD promised that, and I'm told they're still out there.
Well, and instead of having, what, 10 songs on a CD, you had 5 because the audio quality wasn't compressed. Is that how it worked?
Yeah, and they tried to make it work by putting out what would be the equivalent of Walkman. I feel sort of old when we talk about these technologies now. Oh. Because there was a Super Audio CD version of it. You could slap these things in, and they look, ironically, kind of like a zip disc. So maybe not quite the same as computer storage, because they've kind of nailed my problems with computer storage in general.
Yeah.
But the Super Audio CD, yeah, that was the thing I most regret spending money on, you know, if we don't take into account DivX, which I actively fought.
I don't think I've ever had a DivX, but some of those leading edge storage mediums and whatnot, I never bought into because I didn't want to pay for them. I was kind of, hey, if I can get it for free, I'm just going to do that instead. But anyhow, I have 3 of them.
All right, bring it.
Cassette tapes.
Oh, yeah. I had a cassette tape player in my car for the longest time. Hated it.
I had cassettes in just about everything. And I had recordings that people would make off of the other cassette tapes and whatnot.
Oh, now you're going to make me think nostalgically. Oh, we used to make mixtapes, though.
Mixtapes.
And that was so cool.
That was the coolest thing. The problem with the tapes, though, is that depending on the age and style of player you had, it might eat the tape.
Yes.
And then you wouldn't be able to get it out of there because it just unraveled everything.
Toast.
Which was terrible. They didn't survive very well in heat.
No.
Which was, if you left your tapes in your car in the summertime, sometimes you'll come back and there won't be anything on them. And being that they were magnetic media, you needed to keep them away from speakers, because that would actually cause them to get hazy and crackly, and it was just terrible.
Why would you ever have your music somewhere you'd set it on a speaker, right? Because that never happens.
Well, no, because, you know, why? Yeah, exactly. I was going to mention 8-track tapes, but I never actually invested time and effort into 8-track tapes, but they had their own little issues where you had to, like, pack them in and stuff. And
so full disclosure, the very first music I physically owned was an 8-track of the Star Wars soundtrack.
I actually owned an 8-track of Anna Gata DeVita.
Nice.
Yeah.
I feel like that gives you a little more street cred than Star Wars, but...
Yeah, a little bit, maybe.
Depends on the crowd, I guess.
Yeah. The next one I want to bring up is actually a modern storage medium, which is flash media.
Oh, flash media. What kind of flash media? I feel like that's a category, isn't it?
Any flash media.
Oh, okay.
And the reason that I bring that up is not necessarily because it's slow, because it's actually really super fast. It's not because it has limited storage capacity, because it has the best storage capacity.
Right.
It's that it is very use dependent. So a lot like DivX, where you play a movie once, with flash media, you have a definite amount of time when it can be used. And after that, it wears out and it'll start to error, and then you won't be able to use it anymore. Of course, in the PC world, by that time, you have already moved on to your next computer. The issue is that with our older medias, like a magnetic media or even the optical media, you can store that for a definite amount of time. If you have it in a climate-controlled area, you should be able to have magnetic media that lasts years. And it's the same with optical media. But with flash media, all you need to do is just unplug it from your computer. 2-3 years later, it's completely empty because it's lost its electrical charge.
Well, that's a really good point that I hadn't considered. We're moving away from physical hard drives at maybe our own risk culturally, right? Because those machines are eventually all going to rot away somewhere.
Well, of course. And unless it's stored in a data center or in the cloud, which is the preferred method these days to make long-term storage, it's like, well, if it's in the cloud, all they have to do is just unplug the server, or the company goes bankrupt and you lose all your stuff.
Now you're bringing back the early Steam era. We were all so afraid to buy virtual.
Yep.
And now everything is
it's
virtual.
It's the way you buy it. And it's the only way to buy it. Like, you know, you can't go down and... Case in point, was it the latest COD? Mm-hmm. You know, every week there's a 10, 12 gigabyte update to the game, and you have to sit there and allow it to update. Well, if there was an update and you would have to buy it from the store, that's what, 10 double-sided DVDs?
Oh gosh, can you imagine having to install that with floppies like the early days?
Oh, that would be terrible. So the last one that I wanted to bring up was vinyl.
Oh, yeah, which is making a huge comeback. Not sure why.
Yeah. Well, the part that I hated about it was that it was limited. You know, there is a certain nostalgia with vinyl. And for a certain era of our upbringing, which is not really mine, that was the only way to play music. Well, you also had to be really careful with it because it was vinyl. If it was next to a heat source, it became a puddle of vinyl.
Or warped, which is sometimes very entertaining.
Yeah. And that was, you had to be really, really super careful with those because back in the day, they were relatively expensive and you didn't have the climate controlled storage that we have these days. So if you leave it too close to your furnace, go away for a weekend, come back, you have a lot of warped discs and you just lost everything.
I feel like a lot of folks out there are going to argue that the sound quality was better than on CDs or modern streaming media. And there is some truth to that, but there's always an asterisk, always an asterisk, because you lose something every time that you play your vinyl. People don't want to admit it, but they do. Mm-hmm. And you can get lossless audio today in a digital format that is as close to the original recording as you could ever get. People forget that all of those records were recorded off of a DAC, some sort of digital audio recording, and that first burn still caused loss.
So we've talked about what we feel is the worst storage medium that we've ever used, right? So what do you suppose the best one would be?
Oh, gosh, I don't know. I mean, I use my Blu-ray DVD burner a lot, but I don't know that I would say it's the best.
I would go with magnetic rotational media. So like your hard drive.
Oh, okay.
Now, of course, mechanical hard drives are kind of dead, you know, in terms of what we buy for our computer, but we can still get them. Most YouTubers out there will go and buy a 10 terabyte drive to go to add to their NAS just so they can save more of their media and be able to create more videos.
Yeah, I've become very dependent on my NAS because it's a safe backup.
Yeah, and it's local. You own it at that point.
Yeah.
You don't have to upload it to the cloud and worry about that.
And their media servers, which is awesome.
And the thing that I like about the magnetic media is that it lasts. So while people bang on rotational drives as being weak and they will die, you know, like the Death Stars of the old days, right?
Right.
You can still buy a rotational hard drive off of eBay that came out back in the 80s and it will still work. And a lot of times it still has data on it.
So I gotta hold your feet to the fire though, because that's such a broad category. Mm-hmm. What's the best rotational drive?
Oh, the Western Digital Raptor by far, hands down.
Good choice.
Yeah, that drive, it was limited by size, but it was one of the fastest drives that a consumer could buy short of going SAS or SCSI.
Oh, yeah, and spending crazy money.
Yeah, crazy money. Well, in some ways, the Raptor drive was faster than early SSDs, which is really hard to believe now because we have NVMe drives that are just lightning fast. But the fact that Western Digital put so much effort into making this really super fast bulletproof drive is a testament to how far that media platform has come.
Well, yeah, and as a true enthusiast, we kept those, what were they, 74s were the big ones, and rated them 2, 3, 5 at a time to try to keep them alive long past their useful date.
Yeah, see, the early ones were 36 gig, and they matched a lot of the SAS drives that were in Enterprise. And then they upgraded it to 72 gigs. I skipped that generation. And then the next ones were 150, and those were the largest Raptor drives you could buy.
150s, whoosh, and they were a little spendy too, but nothing but crazy.
They also shrunk them. So those were the 2.5-inch drives that were put into a larger cage to make it 3.5 to fit in your regular PC. I still have a couple of those. They're still awesome. And they didn't make a lot of noise, despite spinning at 10,000 RPM.
Yeah, that's pretty amazing. I don't think I could pick anything better than that for my choice either. But, you know, it is really interesting to me as I think about this that, you know, we're almost reaching the point where the next generation, you know, our children, and if not them, definitely their children, are going to grow up in a time where you don't own physical media. You don't own your own music. You don't own your own games. And everything is only really as stable as the server it's on, the cloud it's in, and God help us if someone pulls the plug.
For more information on the topics discussed in this podcast, please consult our show notes on hardwareofsound.com Stay up to date on the latest at Hardwire Asylum by subscribing to our RSS and follow us on Twitter. This has been a Ninja Lane production, copyright 2022. Thanks for listening.